The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of the presentation, they are Forbes Incorporated and William P. Barrett versus Granada Biosciences Incorporated and Granada Foods Corporation from Harris County and the 14th Appellate Judicial District. Next will be Utica National Insurance Company of Texas versus American Indemnity Company and Texas Property and Casualty Insurance Guarantee Association from Travis County and the 3rd Appellate Judicial District. Finally, Delta Airlines Incorporated and Al Perez versus Robert C. Black from Dallas County in the 10th Appellate Judicial District. In each of these matters, the court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court in advance. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and will complete the arguments by noon. Our taping system is somewhat defective this morning, but probably the backup system will work, and you will be able to purchase a copy of any of the arguments on tape from our clerk for a nominal fee. Justice Schneider is not sitting in the first matter. We're ready to hear argument from petitioners in Forbes versus Granada.
May it please the court, Mr. David H. Donaldson, Jr. will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm David Donaldson and I'm here representing the petitioners Forbes Inc. and its reporter, William Barrett. We are asking this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision and reinstate the trial court's grant of summary judgment because, among other reasons, there is no evidence of actual malice with regard to the Forbes article. On the way to making its erroneous determination, the Court of Appeals did not employ the type of rigorous analysis that these cases require, and certainly did not meet the standard that this court has set in its analysis of cases like the Huckabee case and the Turner case, and most recently, the Turner versus Huckabee case. And equally important, the Court of Appeals misapplied Turner and failed to require the kind of specific affirmative proof of actual malice that Turner requires. There's no question, as we review this case, that the actual malice standard applies in this case. That's not an issue before the court, we understand. Clearly, actual malice is the case. And the Court of Appeals erred by trying to...
Nobody disputes that, or is that... is the law of that? Yeah.
Nobody disputes that, Your Honor. And that was a finding of the Court of Appeals, and here, that issue is not being challenged. The Court of Appeals erred by finding that there was a fact issue regarding actual malice as to Forbes and Mr. Barrett's state of mind, and did not tie that conclusion to any alleged false statement of fact. Instead, that whole discussion about actual malice has to do with conversations between Mr. Barrett and the Ellers at a time when the article had already been published, as the Ellers themselves and the respondents themselves in their summary judgment evidence show.
Okay, is it your position that, or is it that where the error is in the failure of the rigorous analysis? If you don't use a rigorous analysis, you would say there is some questions of fact here, but if you apply a rigorous analysis, there is not. Or
Your
are
Honor,
you saying it really doesn't matter what analysis they apply, there's no evidence here?
That it's the latter, Your Honor. There, regardless of how you apply it, our belief is that had they applied the kind of analysis that this court has applied in these kinds of cases, there's no question they would have found no evidence of actual malice. And the factors that the Court of Appeals focused on concern things that happened after the article was published. They focused on matters that related to whether or not a letter could be sent in to be reviewed before the article was published. But there was no specific discussion of any false statements of fact that the Ellers were raising. That by at that point, Mr. Barrett had determined that there was one matter that had been not completely accurate in his article in terms of the identification of one of the plaintiffs who were involved in one of the very serious lawsuits that had been filed against the law, and it was reported on in the story. Now, honestly, the respondents really aren't trying to defend the Court of Appeals' decision. They have a new theory that they're advancing here in this court, that there can be evidence of actual malice because The references in the article, there are references to entities like Granada Corp. And Granada Biosciences,
well,
and Granada.
Let me ask you about that. They quote, and I think we quoted in Turner from Golden Bear, and here's the quotation that I've written down, and that is that the basis of the action lies in the juxtaposition of truthful statements about one company with truthful statements about the illegal operations of an independent company of the same name. You know, why isn't this case on all fours with that statement?
Golden Bear is different, Your Honor, because in Golden Bear there were distinct companies that were not affiliated with one another, other than the fact that they had the same name. In this case, we have an organization, the Granada organization, that includes as part of it the Granada Biosciences, Granada Foods companies, and. So, in that sense, I think that distinguishes.
But the heart of their claim is that they are not the same company. These are separate, publicly traded companies, and therefore the analysis should be the same. There's no allegation that there's any sort of disrespect of the corporate entity. My understanding of the basis of their claim is this is a separate, corporate, publicly traded entity that's been tainted by being thrown in with the sort of parent corporation.
Well, Mr. Donaldson, didn't in fact Mr. Barrett say in his affidavit on several occasions that even though he used the term generically Granada or Granada, that he really didn't mean GBC or GBI or GFC in certain situations? Didn't he actually admit that in his affidavit?
In his affidavit, he does refer to the fact that he discussed Granada generically, but he also makes it very clear that when he intended to talk about Granada Biosciences and Granada Foods specifically, he mentioned them specifically, and their names appear specifically. And in the course of another distinction to Golden Bear is that in this article, there are references to various parts of Granada Corporation. There's a reference right in the headline to Granada Corporation. There's a reference to the Granada Organization. That is identified as a series of private and public entities. There's a reference to some partnerships that were part of the Granada Organization before they became part of the public companies. So there's a distinction that's drawn there, as opposed to trying to suggest that both these references to Golden Bear are exactly the same company. There are references in here that make distinctions between the companies, the organization itself broadly, or Granada Corp, or the individual companies, Granada Biosciences, Granada Foods. And more importantly, that while there may be some argument over how this can be read and whether Granada makes reference to Granada Biosciences, Granada Foods, to a reasonable reader, that's not the issue before the court here. The issue is actual malice. What did Mr. Barrett intend? And the evidence before the court is that there's no indication that he intended, when he said Granada, the organization generally, that that was going to be specifically about Granada Biosciences or Granada Foods. Indeed, the evidence is the opposite. He intended, when he said Granada Biosciences, Granada Foods, he only intended to discuss them when he discussed Granada Biosciences and Granada Foods.
Those two statements may be accurate based on the record, but there's another part of this that's pointed out in some of the briefing that even though Mr. Barrett used Granada generically to refer to the family of companies or the whole set of companies and entities, he did state on several occasions in his affidavit, did he not, that on some of those occasions when he used Granada generically, he did not intend it to apply to one or both of the specific respondents here, didn't he?
Well, as he went through each of the passages, yes. Well, I think the way the evidence set up, the way the affidavit is set up, is that he says that when I intended to speak specifically about Granada Biosciences and Granada Foods, I mentioned them by name. And I did discuss Granada, the organization, generically. And that organization is some of the private companies, Granada Corp., and it includes, in general, Granada Foods and Granada Biosciences as part of that total organization. And the problem here now raises the issue of a group libel claim. Our concern is that when you talk about a group of folks and then you talk about specific people, if you're not under the group libel theory, the fact that you mentioned something about a general group cannot be claimed by individuals, specific individuals, as being about them specifically.
Well, what happens if you identify them as being part of the general group? What happens if you identify, Granada has a series of organizations and it's a parent and has interest in so many organizations, and you list all these organizations. And then the entire balance of the article is, I'm going to talk now about Granada as an organization. then you talk about all the bad stuff about Grenada's organization. Do you escape the malice deal by saying, oh, gee, if I intended to talk about that group, I mentioned it specifically, but I didn't really intend to talk about that group when I'm talking about the organization, except the beginning of the argument, the article, begins by identifying all these organizations. Can you escape liability based on lack of actual malice by arguing, well, you know, it's such a broad term, it couldn't possibly mean I was specifically referring to it?
Yes, you can. And because the way that this article is set up and the way it read the article, it does identify a group, Granada organization, but then it discusses specifically Granada Biosciences, Granada Foods, when it attempts to discuss them. And the other issue on your response is, well, suppose that you say something that's true as to the whole group. Well, it is true as to the whole group if there's some other entity that committed that activity. In other words, if you say the Granada organization had an entity that had an issue about backdating documents, that is true. The problem is that's not about Granada Foods or Granada Biosciences. But it is true as the Granada organization in general. And that's the problem. In group libel cases, which is the beginning of your question, the whole idea is that the people who are complaining about the statement made about the group are members of the group. And the problem is that if the statement's about a group and they are members of the group, their argument is, well, that wasn't true as to me, and therefore I have been liable, even though the discussion is true as to certain other members of the group. And that's our whole point. You apply that group libel analysis. Initially, you don't even get to the actual malice issue because ultimately the article, anytime it refers to Granada, you apply that analysis, it's substantially true. But more importantly, if you're not satisfied with that analysis, you still have to look at the issue of actual malice and what did the author intend. The respondents have set this case up before this court essentially arguing that Turner didn't say what it said. In Huckabee and in Turner and most recently in the Bentley versus Bunton case, this court has made it clear that you cannot use a claim that an article or a publication or a broadcast creates a false impression and then assert that actual malice existed when the person that created that publication or broadcast never intended it to be taken in the fashion that's now being claimed by the respondents. The respondents, if in fact that the rule is that you have to show that it was intended to be taken in the fashion that the respondents claim, they have to show that intent in order to prove actual malice, they lose. And they do lose because under Huckabee and Turner and Bentley, this court has made it clear if you're going to make a false impression case, you've got to show that that was part of the intention of the people who put the presentation together.
And that the argument, the respondent argues that you are carving out reckless indifference in that argument. Is that your position?
I don't understand the suggestion of reckless indifference. I don't believe that that's our case. Our case is whether you show intent, whether you have to show either intent, or even if you have to show knowledge. Under either standard, they don't meet that here.
No, it's the Supreme Court. They use different terms for it, but they say reckless disregard or three different terms, but it means the same.
It still means the same.
It's so bad that you ought to have known.
That's right. Did they know or strongly suspect? I think it's the language this court has used. And there's no evidence here before this court or in the record that shows that Mr. Barrett knew or strongly suspected that when he talked about the Granada organization generally or talked about another Granada entity without. He intended to talk about Granada Biosciences or Granada Foods.
Well, your magazine has part of what they want to do is have an effect on the market. If no stock ever went up or down based on your stories, you probably wouldn't sell 700,000 copies of each edition, right?
Well, I think it is our hope that people will listen to us and will be interested in what we have to say. Yeah.
So, you're... title was The Incredible Vanishing Empire, and the subtitle talked about $2 billion versus $200 million, which would get the average investor's attention, I think. Was the $2 billion number based on anything other than the comment from the spouse that was that she corrected when the accountant walked in during the same phone conversation?
No, it's not, it is based on the comments by Linda Eller concerning the $2 billion, $2 to $3 billion, actually, I believe is what she said initially.
And then in the same phone conversation, she revised that down.
There's a that's in her affidavit or in testimony, that's what the claim was made, yes. I think it's in the telephone conversation with Mr. Barrett after the article has been published. She claims that that's what she did.
Are there any cases at all discussing, you know, whether a reporter might be guilty of actual malice by intentionally closing his ears or mind to the other side of the argument? That, you know, the reporter knows that there are two sides, and there's one side that is right and one side is wrong, and the reporter takes side A and decides just not even to inquire about side B or not to accept any of side B's point of view. Is there ever actual malice in that context?
In the Partakes versus Connaughton case, the United States Supreme Court addressed that issue. And the facts of that case are important because in that case there was an allegation that a candidate for office had offered gifts and a job to someone to come forward and give damaging testimony to someone who was related to his opponent. And the candidate learned of that allegation before the publication. Presented five witnesses that said, no, that's not true, that's not the conversation that happened. Presented a tape recording of the conversation and also identified another neutral witness that wasn't affiliated at all with the candidate. Said, you need to go talk to these people before you publish that. And they didn't do any of those things. They did not listen to the tape recording. They did not try to find a neutral witness. Yes, those things happened. However, this court has also recognized and did so in the Huckabee case. That if you have someone who is actively researching, who does talk to both sides, who did speak with the company, several officials with the company, which Mr. Barrett did, and did do research, did look at the public filings, in the Huckabee case, this court recognized when you have that kind of extensive research, that eliminates a claim of purposeful avoidance of the truth. And even to make a claim of purposeful avoidance, you have to show that there's some reason to doubt the information that you have. And in this context, there is no basis for finding that Mr. Barrett had reason to doubt. Sure, there were disagreements. Sure, there were denials. But none of those things are enough to show actual malice.
Let me ask you this. Where is our focus in looking at actual malice? Do we look at Barrett's subjective intent in terms of how he termed the entities? Or do we look at what a reasonable reader would perceive in terms of the juxtaposition? Where do we start?
You start with Barrett's subjective intent. Remember, this is an actual malice case, which requires proof that Mr. Barrett knew what he was saying was false or probably false. And as part of that
so
proof...
So you're saying we have to take his word from his affidavit that he intended to refer to the whole organization when he used the word Granada, except where he specified otherwise. We have to take that at face value, regardless of how it could be perceived to the average reader.
It's not what a reader believes and understands what the writer intends. It's not what the reader takes out of it, it's what the writer intends. Now, I don't want to take that too far. Sure, could there be situations where it's just totally unreasonable for Mr. Barrett to think that a reader...
But how do we determine that? How do we determine where you take it too far? Because that seems like a pretty easy analysis. He says this is what he intended, we go no further, but how do we, where do we stop that analysis?
The way that you start is to look at his affidavit and see what he says, what his intent is, and then look at the content of the story itself and see if it supports that intent. People may disagree, but if it is one of the things that, if in reviewing the article you can see how his position could be accurate, then there's no evidence to rebut or no suggestion that when he says, this is what I intended, there's nothing to suggest otherwise. It is enough and should be the standard that he said, this is what I intended to say, and the article, with a reasonable reading, fairly supports that, then that should be the standard.
Let me add one more question, if I might. you say in the brief that Granada had to prove by summary judgment evidence that the omission or the misleading juxtaposition, they have to specifically show how that caused the false impression. How do you create summary judgment evidence on what that juxtaposition conveys? What does summary judgment evidence look like in that respect?
I think in that situation, before you even have to talk about evidence, you have to talk about what is their position. They have to set out what they believe the article says.
So it's a pleading. So it's a pleading issue and not a summary judgment evidence issue then?
It depends on the circumstances. I can see it as definitely is a pleading issue. You have to know what it is, the impression they think is created by the article. You have to set that out specifically. That must be the standard. And then at that point, whether there may be evidence that may be relevant to that or not, it may depend on the circumstances.
And what evidence, what does that evidence look like of the false impression?
Potentially it could look like I suppose a situation where the reporter himself says, after I read it, I realized that it had that impression. It could be an admission and a deposition to that effect. It could be testimony from others concerning their understanding of the article once they read it.
Mr. Donaldson, I know you've been there a while, but I've got a couple of more questions.
I'm here at the court to play.
In regard to Justice Jefferson's question, are you asking this court to establish a new pleading requirement, that is, establish and cite provably false factual connotations, which I think you would say is implied in the Turner versus KTRK case? I think the amicus brief was a little more direct about it, you believe that there should be that the provably false connotation should be set out. If that's in the appellate context, I would imagine that you'd believe that should be a pleading requirement in the trial courts for this type of a case. Is that what you're asking?
Yes, we are. We do believe that that's where this court should end up. But here, all we're asking is for this court to affirm the district court's motion for grant of the motion for summary judgment. I think that's where you end up. And I think that is the standard now. Under pleading requirements, you have to at least give some notice of what it is that you're claiming. And I think in this situation, the way this court has set up the standards, that you have to give notice of what impression you believe the article creates.
But under your analysis, even if you were to presume that there was a provably false connotation, you go back to what he actually intended when he wrote that provably false connotation, or when he wrote the article that connoted something that was provably false. And if there's any way to read the article to support his statement of his intent, we have to go with that.
In an actual malice case, when you have the reporter stating and giving a declaration of his intent, and the article and the content of the article is consistent with that declaration of intent, yes. The bottom line is, did he intend for it to be read that way? And if you show that he didn't intend for it to be read that way, you can then try to visit upon him some different interpretation and claim that, well, you knew that was false.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Ralph Kerrigan will present argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, if the court will give me approximately 2 minutes, I think that I can explain our position in a way that will be pretty clear with this, and that is how we think that this case ought to be submitted to a jury in such a way that this court can meet all of the constitutional requirements. We do not dispute, in view of the same case, which we believe is the best authority now, that we apparently have in this type of situation two constitutional hurdles to overcome. We recognize that in this case there is an intent problem. Our only argument is not that intent doesn't enter into it, but intent, just as knowledge in actual malice, intent includes a reckless disregard, or otherwise you have no possibility of ever proving the matter. Now, our issue, the way we have decided that this matter should be submitted is tempered somewhat by your recent decision in Smith versus Harris County, which I recognize was a split decision. But as I understood it, all of the parties agreed that on liability factors, that Castillo case applied, and the general charge is a problem if it doesn't take care of the simple fact of liability issue. And in this case, we do not believe that there would be a general charge. What we would submit that if we have the opportunity to return to the district court is there would be approximately 9 or 10 issues with regard to statements in the article that we say applied in the mind of the reasonable Forbes reader to Granada Foods and or Granada Bio. And what we would suggest using an example and shortchanging on the words is issue number one, answer the following questions with regard to the statement taken below from the article. And I'll use one example. Possibly anticipating a bankruptcy filing, former Granada employees say officials in recent months have moved some farm equipment and vehicles off of Granada books and gotten rid of backup documentation. First question out of the restatement in the Croissant case at the 14th Court is, would the average Forbes reader reasonably understand under all the circumstances that this statement applied to Granada Bioscience? One, Granada Foods. Are we home free? No. The next question would be, did Mr. Barrett intend or with reckless disregard write his article in such a manner that the average Forbes reader would reasonably understand that it applied to Granada Foods, Granada Bio? Next question.
So your fundamental disagreement then with the opposing counsel is where you start. What he told me just now was that it's the subjective intent of Barrett, and if the text will support that, even though a reasonable reader might find something else, if the text will support his statement of intent, we have to go with that. He would disagree with that.
I disagree with him, just as you first asked where the question is false. Then you go down the line in a regular defamation case. Here, you follow the restatement to...
But in order to determine whether it's false, we have to first decide whether it's as to these companies specifically. And so we've got to see what the intent is in order to determine whether it's false.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's exactly what I'm trying to do in the very first issue. Does the average reader reasonably understand that applies to one or both of these companies? Then you go to the constitutional lineup. Did Barrett write it in such a way that he either intended or used reckless disregard in how he wrote it so that that would be how it would be understood? Then you go to the malice questions. First, you follow that with, was it false? Was it defamatory? And then you go down to whether or not the action by Alice, did he know or in exercise of exercise reckless disregard with whether or not this was true or not. Now,
you argue that the use of the general term Granada may have been taken and may have been intended to be taken as inclusive of the two public companies.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you also argue that statements about the two public companies themselves were false on their face?
Your Honor, I would, and I looked at that question, I think there are probably one or two that we might submit to a jury, but to me the basis of this case, and put it on the line, is that the defamation, the damage comes from the use of the general term that is understood to apply in these many, some 8, 9, 10 instances to give the impression to the average reader that this is where what Granada Foods and Granada Bio are about. I think I would, if I had to argue, try and be as straight and correct as, if I had to argue that the statements that expressly refer to a general bio or general foods, I don't think I'd be in front of this court at this time.
And there is an argument that's been made toward the end of our briefing that when we have this false impression theory, sort of a, not to shorthand it too much, but the kind of theory that we talked about in turn, that the defendant has a right to know what the plaintiff thinks is the false impression that is being conveyed. Do you agree with that or not?
I agree with that, and would point out to the court that the 14th court decided that there were 19 references to different statements within there. I'm just appalled at the suggestion that petitioners had given that they were not on notice of this particular situation.
And so your basic, the gist of your position, not to boil it down too much, but is that the general references to Granada in this article and attribution of conduct, maybe misconduct, to that appellation should have been, the reporter should have either intended or he should have known that that was going to be taken to refer to these other countries.
Yes, sir. First step, reckless disregard there. Second step, once you get through falsity and that it was a matter of actual mountains. So I think that's as clear as a position as I can make on the situation.
Mr. Kerrigan, what do you contend were the actual instances of evidence in the record of actual malice? Just give us a list. What do you contend?
Probably violating principle, but may I ask the question, you want the actual malice or the reckless disregard with regard to references, because I'm talking about the actual malice is,
asking about actual malice as we've defined it, to include both intent and reckless disregard in this situation.
Let me take a number of statements in, and I guess the strongest example I can give you is toward the conclusion that we set out after referring to present time, after referring to general bio and general foods, we go into this last three paragraphs, which to me, I know I'm wrapped up in this, are appalling. But the first is that in the Houston court pleading this summer, one Granada entity acknowledged huge unpaid legal bills, a virtual admission of insolvency. Are they talking about, they're talking about Granada management that's never been mentioned, nobody knows is in existence, and yet they follow that after all this stuff about the two public companies, they put that in. And by Mr. Barrett's own admission, if you're over the first hump, that he made this representation or inference with reckless disregard, you automatically have then the actual malice, because it's false as to the two companies, it's defamatory as to the two companies, and it had to be done with reckless disregard. So
Let me clarify my question.
A merger of the
let
two.
Me clarify my question, refocus you a little bit. What is the evidence of the writer's state of mind?
All right. The writer's state of mind starts with his background, and that is he's a lawyer. That he has been with Forbes for a number of years. That he is aware that what they say affects the market condition of public companies. That he then, by his own admission, lumps two public companies that are being traded on the stock exchange in with a group of other companies. And by the way, they talk about party companies and so on. The opening statement in this is 1989, the Wall Street Journal talks about a Houston-based parent of several public companies and private entities. You've already narrowed the field down. There's no 42 companies involved in here. But just like the statement that I read about the huge unpaid legal bills, which is bad enough as it is, because he took it out of the pleadings where they're trying to get a company that has one of these D&O policies to pay up as they run up these bills, and they call that a virtual admission of insolvency, but it's about Houston Management. All they had to do was put parentheses there, Houston Management. Okay, then you know it's not involved. Then they go down to the next one after that and said, next paragraph, possibly anticipating. I'm going to take 1 second to tell you that I had a reputation back in my early trial days. I was making a jury argument, and I dropped my notes, and two of my partners swear that five of the jurors got up to help me pick them up, but that was not intended. The next statement is with regard to possibly anticipating bankruptcy, and they go, former Granada employees, they moved farm equipment off and got rid of backup documents. By Barrett's own admission, that doesn't apply to either one of these companies.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's take Enron, for example. That's the obvious example. There are many articles written about the entities, the sort of generic Enron name. And maybe by way of example, something could mention a specific entity. Is it your position that in order to avoid any sort of business disparagement claim, it has to be set out that when we refer to the overall entity, we're not talking about this particular sub or this particular sub or this particular entity? Does there have to be a disclaimer?
No, Your Honor, and let me tell you the difference between Enron and here. Enron is a parent. Enron is the one who is being publicly traded. All these subsidiaries down here are not being, so that anything that they do down here rises up to affect the stock of Enron. We don't have that situation here. We have Granada Corporation, which is private, having and owning two public corporations that are being traded. And so they turn around and talk about all the things that Eller allegedly, they say, is doing with Granada Corporation, and never once distinguish that these two down here, the public traded ones, are not guilty of these effects. And who is the important ones are the public investors and those who have their money tied up in those two corporations. So to me, there is a fundamental difference between Enron and in the Granada situation.
Are you saying that because Forbes is a market-focused publication, the only purpose behind writing this article would be to be about publicly traded corporations?
Well, I wouldn't say that's the only purpose, but I would say by Mr. Barrett's own deposition testimony, he recognizes that what he says and what they say has an effect on market, and they go out to some 700,000 investors. So if I could rephrase the court's question, make it principal purpose, yes.
So would it matter, assume that you look at the intent of the writer, and if it could be read the way the writer wants it to read, then there's no malice, but if you look at the publication that it's put in, it might not be a reasonable interpretation of the article because the publication really is focused on public markets.
Absolutely, and I think that's exactly what the restatement says. It is, what does it mean to the audience to which this was addressed or intended for? And yes, if I guess if it was in Vogue magazine, I'm not sure it had much effect on the market whatsoever. But the fact of what, who and what Forbes is, Your Honor, yes. Going on with we know that Granada, by Barrett's own admission, the moving of these, any information he had on moving the equipment off and doctoring the books, does not apply to either of these two public companies. Why doesn't he say so? Just parentheses, Granada Corporation parentheses. But even then he goes further, and in that same paragraph, he says more of this hanky-panky is with regard to the company, a Granada executive employee admitted he backdated a document. Now, the 14th court picked up on that. First of all, this is a horrible statement in the fact that what happened is the backdating itself has a disclaimer advising the public. This, I made this on such a date, the director signed it on such a date, to backdate it at the time. There was no hanky-panky, it was wide open. But it wasn't even a Granada employee, it was an employee of some outfit called Intermodular something or other, I've forgotten now, which was 70% owned by Granada Corporation. All he's got to do is stick in parentheses, Intermodular Corporation. He says a Granada employee, with all this running together, and then coming to the final conclusion down here, that his unfortunate fellow shareholders, how can anybody read anything but the fact that Mr. Barrett and all the readers knew that those last three paragraphs were referring to these public entities. Then I can return to the malice or the reckless disregard part that in the earlier instruction because, for example, what they have in there the plans to set up a vertically integrated operation including eateries and retail stores founded. Now, who reading that would think for 1 minute that these partnerships back in 1987 were in business of doing food and retail stores? Wouldn't anybody reading that think that this applied to Granada Foods? And right above it, Granada lost a $30 million speculating in cattle. He admits that he got most of this information from a, quote, confidential source. I hope Discovery, if and when we are returned, will find out about this confidential source. But the plans that this speculation, he says, was back in the partnership. But let me, if you put this story together, in 1989 from the first paragraph, we know that there were only several companies and private entities. We drop down and we now know before those coming in, that those partnerships were rolled over into these private two public companies.
Any questions?
I'm sorry, Young.
I'm asking for other questions.
I apologize. I was thinking red was green, but that's.
Well, at least you didn't try to cover it up.
I appreciate the question. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Pick up the rest of my notes.
Mr. Donaldson, two questions. One in Turner, at page 120, the chief, writing for the court, states that although actual malice focuses on the defendant's state of mind, a plaintiff can prove it through objective evidence about the publication's circumstances. If there is a disagreement in the parties' positions, one saying state of mind was no malice, actual malice intended, the other saying objective circumstances, or at least arguing that, lead to a conclusion of actual malice. Do we have a fact question entitling the parties to present their case to a jury or not?
Well, Your Honor, it depends on the evidence as presented of the objective circumstances. But in this case, there aren't any objective circumstances that can support an inference of actual malice or even raise a fact question about actual malice. One of the things that I think is different about this case is that we have a race jesti statement, if you will, in the tape-recorded conversation between Mr. Barrett and the Ellers, in which he says, you know, I interviewed all these people, I really believed it to be true, but if there's something that you think is an error, let me know. And, in fact, in the one instance where he had found out after the publication that there was an error with regard to a gentleman named Ed Bass, that was corrected in the next issue of the... And Mr. Barrett, in this conversation with Eller, expresses his dissatisfaction with the fact that he had ended up getting that part wrong. There's no objective evidence that Mr. Barrett knew that what he had published was false.
Well, you're leading right into my second question. The parties in the briefing argue about different occurrences that they take different positions on whether they show or are probative of actual malice, the state of mind or not. The alleged broken promise to let Granada reviewed the article before it was published, the arguments about whether the corrections deadline was misleadingly stated or not, whether that's even relevant, Ely's affidavit where he said Mr. Barrett was showing or attempting to get him to show ill will toward Granada, and the argument that there's an absence of a written policy or even articulated policy by Forbes regarding verification of facts. Parties have argued about at least those four things that impinge on or may relate to the state of mind here. How does that play into your argument?
Your Honor, we believe that none of those items individually out after the publication, that there was an error with regard to a gentleman named Ed Bass, that was corrected in the next issue of the... And Mr. Barrett, in this conversation with Eller, expresses his dissatisfaction with the fact that he had ended up getting that part wrong. There's no objective evidence that Mr. Barrett knew that what he had published was false.
Well, you're leading right into my second question. The parties in the briefing argue about different occurrences that they take different positions on whether they show or are probative of actual malice, the state of mind or not. The alleged broken promise to let Granada review the article before it was published, the arguments about whether the corrections deadline was misleadingly stated or not, whether that's even relevant. Ely's affidavit where he said Mr. Barrett was showing or attempting to get him to show ill will toward Granada, and the argument that there's an absence of a written policy or even articulated policy by Forbes regarding verification of facts. Parties have argued about at least those four things that impinge on or may relate to the state of mind here. How does that play into your argument?
Your Honor, we believe that none of those items individually are any evidence of actual malice, and add them all up, and it's still not evidence of actual malice. If you're adding 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, you still get 0. Broken promises, there's no indication that Mr. Barrett knew that any of the statements in his article were false. And there's no suggestion that he knew a specific problem was there, and he did not want to hear the other side. All he did in that situation was simply deny him an opportunity to give another second denial to some of the things they already denied. With Mr. Isle's comment about ill will, this court has already made it pretty clear that ill will is not a basis for finding.
Standing alone,
finding actual malice. And I don't think adding it to broken promises gets you there either. The absence of a written policy, there's no expert testimony or anything to the effect that the way Forbes does its operation is sloppy or shows no interest in getting the truth. In fact, Mr. Barrett's testimony was that in addition to having written the story, before he submitted it, he had to go through and specifically double-check his facts against his sources, against the information that he had. And there's in the record, there is a list of all the facts that he had in the story, and they're okays next to each of them.
And he'd been working on that article or that story a couple of years, didn't he say?
It depends on what you mean by working on. He had been paying attention to Granada because Granada had been sending him information trying to encourage him to write a story. And I don't think he actually got down to writing a story until a month or so before the story actually appeared. But that actually brings up another issue that I want to follow up on, and that is that
any,
in the materials that the Granada people were sending...
Any questions?
I'd like to hear the follow-up. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. In the materials that Granada was sending to him, it was frequent that Granada themselves would refer to the Granada organization generally.
Do you agree with Mr. Kerrigan's distinction about the Enron example, that so there's a public-private distinction, you have to be more careful in reporting on a publicly held company?
Not at all, Your Honor. Forbes talks about lots of different companies. It does talk about public companies, but it also talks about private ones as well. I think under Mr. Kerrigan's, under the arguments being made here, if there was an Enron subsidiary that did not cook the books, that if there was a statement that Enron cooked the books, one of the subsidiaries could come in and say, well, I'm part of Enron, I'm a subsidiary, I'm part of that, and you said that we cooked the books, and you knew that we didn't cook the books, and so it created a liable claim in that fashion.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first clause. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.